and for this gift that is presented every year to the Palestinian people.
This aid provided by the Islamic Republic of Iran during the month of Ramadan to the Palestinian people is considered as proof of Iran's great role and the interdependence between the Iranian and Palestinian people. These activities confirm the loyalty of the Palestinian people to the axis of resistance, in addition to the fundamental and strategic role of Syria and Iran in the axis of resistance.
With this humanitarian aid, Iran demonstrates that true support lies in actions rather than words, and it reflects the enduring place of the Palestinian cause in every Iranian's heart.
This gift is not only a gesture of love from the Iranian leadership and people. More importantly, it underscores their unwavering commitment to help their Palestinian brethren wherever they are. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Pensioners rallied in hundreds of towns and cities in France against President Emmanuel Macron's determination for even more austerity cuts amid the inflation crisis. When campaigning in 2017, Macron promised he wouldn't cut pensions and that their purchasing power relative to inflation would be preserved. 7 years later, inflation has progressed 17%, while pensions have been increased just 8%. Along with his widely protested pension rollback and age hike by decree in 2023, the gap between inflation increases and pension increases may explain why perhaps no sector of society has turned against Macron more than retirees.
Think about it. How is an elderly pensioner who is largely stuck at home and unable to work is supposed to make up this gap? Now add in the increases we all see in food, heating, and electricity prices, and you can see why pensioners are so upset with Macron.
Oh, on n'est pas malheureux.
I'm active in senior citizen politics, and several years back, many pensioners would not be interested when we would distribute information leaflets to them. They'd say things like, oh, we're not unhappy, or others are poorer than us. But I can report that in recent months, no pensioner is saying that or refusing our help. That's how bad it's gotten in France, and especially in the quality of our healthcare.
Paris has warned there will soon be a second round of austerity cuts to the already austerity 2024 budget.
There are so many retirees who live on less than 900 euros per month, and everyone should be able to comprehend how difficult that is. Many of us have also diseases like cancer and diabetes, and I can promise you that none of us asked for them. We deserve dignity, and not to be treated like we are some sort of lower class citizen just because we have finished our working career.
An alternative to public service cuts would be increased taxes on the rich or corporate shareholders. But the Macron administration said it doesn't want to go digging into the pockets of the French. As the average household is still reeling from COVID and the disastrous backfiring of Europe's sanctions on Russia, a report from Oxfam found that France's billionaire families have gained 230 billion euros since 2020. That's enough to give a check of 3,400 euros to every single French person. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
To mark the National Day of Resilience and the 9th anniversary of the Saudi-led war on Yemen, Yemenis have organized multiple events across the country. This year, they are also expressing their support for the people of Palestine as Israel carries out a genocide in the Gaza Strip. Several high-ranking officials participated in these events.
Today, we celebrate steadfastness and standing up against an aggression that has continued for years. We are defending ourselves and resisting politically, economically and militarily in the face of the barbaric aggression in which the whole world has allied with, and a siege that is still in place. Although 9 years have passed, the aggression is still ongoing and the siege has not stopped. Therefore, we will continue to stand together until the war stops completely.
Officials state that the Saudi-led war continues despite failing to achieve its stated objectives. They argue that the U.S. does not want the war to end, aiming to subdue the Yemenis, especially after Yemen began its naval operations in support of Palestine.
There are lots of agendas that were not achieved by the war in Yemen, and therefore America wants to at least reach the rest of its goals regarding Yemen. But the truth is that a Yemeni victory has been achieved, and we have imposed our presence. We united in political, military, and social levels, so Yemen succeeded in absorbing the strategic transformations, imposing itself in the Red and Arabian Seas, and supporting the Palestinian cause. America has no choice but to accept this reality.
In the meantime, the spokesman for the Yemeni army reported 6 military operations over the past 3 days. These operations included targeting 3 American and British vessels with missiles and drones in the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea, while another vessel heading to Israeli-occupied ports was also hit. The Yemeni army also launched an attack on 2 U.S. destroyers. Yemeni forces also successfully struck the occupied territories with ballistic missiles.
After 9 years of U.S.-backed war and siege, observers believe that Yemen today is stronger than ever, being the only country to have supported Palestine through military action. They argue that Yemenis are confident they are on the right path as long as Washington continues to bombard and terrorize them. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
For more than 170 days, the Israeli operations in the besieged Gaza Strip have resulted in the deaths of more than 32,000 individuals. The latest incident involves an attack on Al-Shifa Hospital, where witnesses have reported extensive atrocities. In reaction, Iranians assembled in front of the Turkish embassy on Monday to voice their indignation.
People gathered here to condemn Israeli genocide in Gaza, urging Muslim states, including Turkey, to halt exporting energy to the regime.
Participants lament that the international community has thus far remained silent regarding Israel.
We as women have come here with our children because we witnessed the Israeli action against Palestinian women and children. Sadly, the international community has remained silent.
Regrettably, Turkey as a Muslim nation exports significant raw materials, including metal, to Israel. If Turkey were to cut off this supply and prevent exports to Israel through the Ceyhan port, it would exert considerable pressure on Israel. We also call on other Muslim countries, like Azerbaijan, which supplies 40% of Israel's oil, to cease their support.
This plea follows Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, leader of the Islamic Revolution, urging Muslim nations to cut political and economic ties with Israel. Protesters also cited Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, who highlighted the role of Muslims in opposing Israel by saying, "If the Muslims of the world united and each poured a bucket of water, Israel would be washed away." Farzana Shuryun, Tehran.
In the Great Mosque of the Old City of Sana'a, the Yemeni Scholars Association convened a meeting calling for the nation's scholars to fulfill their role in the Al-Aqsa Fluid Battle and the ensuing victory. The event saw a significant turnout of Yemeni scholars.
Our message to the scholars who have shirked their responsibility to support Gaza is to fear God, for that will expose them to God's punishment in this world and the hereafter. Silence regarding what our brothers endure in Gaza amounts to participating in the Zionist enemies' crimes against children and women. The people will also justify their silence with the silence of their scholars and rulers. Therefore, their sin is greater than that of the rest of the people.
The participants criticized the inaction of Muslim scholars regarding the atrocities in Gaza, labeling it the genocidal war by Israel. They emphasized the scholars' profound responsibility, asserting their religious duty to support their Palestinian brothers. They argued that the current situation in Palestine is the consequence of decades of silence.
The responsibility of the scholars is great, as they are the ones who can move the streets and the people, and they can compel the rulers to act with the fatwa or word from them in support of Gaza.
Since the onset of the war on Gaza, Yemeni scholars have actively participated in weekly demonstrations supporting Palestine and have encouraged public demonstrations in solidarity. Furthermore, the Scholars Association has declared its support for the Yemeni military's naval operations targeting Israeli maritime activities and its allies.
Yemeni scholars assert that the normalization deals between Arab countries and Israel have emboldened the regime to continue its oppressive campaign against Palestinians. They urge all Muslim scholars to advocate for Palestine, regardless of their government's positions. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shah al-Sudani will meet with U.S. President Joe Biden in Washington on April 15 for talks on the U.S. military presence in the Arab country. Also, a range of other issues, including the fight against Daesh and the ongoing Iraqi financial reforms, will be discussed.
The demands of Iraqi nation and political blocs will be taken to Washington by the Prime Minister. We all know there is a large consensus in the country to end the foreign forces' presence. The Prime Minister will also discuss the economic situation and challenges, most importantly, the U.S. dollar exchange rates, which have been affecting the market since the imposition of sanctions by U.S. Treasury on Iraqi banks.
In January, Baghdad and Washington began formal talks about ending the coalition mission, purportedly formed to help the Iraqi forces to fight Daesh terrorist group. After the defeat of Daesh in 2017 by Iraqi anti-terror forces, the U.S. still stationed some 2,500 troops in Iraq and 900 in neighboring Syria as a part of the coalition mission.
It's time for the government to end the coalition mission. It's the demand of the Iraqi people. We all agree that these forces have gone too far, violating our sovereignty, so today we witnessed a call by the Iraqi nation that the time has come for these forces to leave.
Following the parliamentary decision in 2020, Iraqi authorities have agreed for drawing up a timeline to end the presence of foreign forces, which proved by action to be a threat to the country's stability. Iraqi nation agrees that foreign forces' presence is no longer necessary, and the Prime Minister will carry their demands to Washington. Muslim Salem, Baghdad.
Salman Qasimi, an Islamic school teacher, says it's an unprecedented move in India to ban madrasas instantly, calling it a blow to marginalized Muslim families across India's most populous state of Uttar Pradesh. He says lives of thousands of families are directly dependent on such institutions, while the government of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi accuses them of receiving illegal funding. Scholars argue such institutions are building blocks of Islamic teachings across the country, which regular schools can't do.
This judgment is unfortunate. We respect the court decision, but we oppose it. Our constitution allows us to have such schools to teach Islamic values to future generations. If this is against secularism, why it was made in the first place? Every citizen can read, write, promote or propagate their religion. That's what our constitution says. Madrasa's instant closure is a blow to livelihood of thousands of families.
In January, the government of Uttar Pradesh state halted a funding program for madrasas, leaving more than 20,000 teachers unemployed. Scholars say Friday's verdict applies to all Islamic schools in the state that are privately and government funded. In recent months, India's northeastern state of Assam converted hundreds of madrasas into conventional schools.
All the laws and all the things which are BJP is enacting or BJP is targeting the Muslim community, definitely they think that the if they want to rule the country, so they can rule the country when they can demonize Muslim community, they can suppress Muslim community, they can make them wetless at the time of election. So all these efforts are taking place because of the RSS background, RSS agenda of the present ruling party.
In recent months, Modi's government turned down new proposals from the states and halted payments to schemes that would finance Muslim schools. Critics say this amounts to snatching the livelihood of thousands of families instantly, while they have no other means of earning.
India will hold general elections in a few weeks' time, and the BJP's victory is imminent, according to observers. Activists and rights groups have accused the governing party of promoting anti-Islamic rhetoric in a deliberate attempt to appease the majority voters by polarizing the voters, therefore using divide-and-rule policy to win the elections.
Rights groups have accused the BJP government of persecuting and intimidating Muslims through all possible means. The accusation BJP rejects, saying India is a vibrant democracy enshrined in equality for all. Critics accuse the ruling party of systematic repression against the largest minority group, including hate crimes, mob lynching and cow vigilantism, amid rising Islamophobia. Observers say such issues pave the way for Prime Minister Modi to remain in office for a third consecutive term. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Pakistan has joined the global celebrations of a very special Nowruz that has coincided with the holy month of Ramadan. Nowruz, which translates to New Day, is celebrated by millions of peoples worldwide as the Persian New Year, symbolizing rebirth, renewal, and arrival of spring.
To all my fellow Pakistanis celebrating Nowruz, I say let's cherish our cultural diversity and come together in solidarity. May this new year bring us prosperity, peace, and happiness.
Despite its Persian origins, Nowruz in Pakistan is celebrated with a distinctive local flavor, incorporating regional traditions and customs. Pakistanis have their own customs to welcome Nowruz. Besides preparing special meals and decorating the dining area with special dried and fresh fruits, the ancient occasion also creates an opportunity for individuals to mend broken ties, forgive others, let go of the past, and build stronger relationships in the coming new year.
For me, Nowruz is a time of reflection and renewal. It's a reminder to leave behind the past year's troubles and embrace the opportunities that lie ahead. It's a celebration of life, growth, and the beauty of nature.
We clean our house, we visit our friends, we celebrate this day, we enjoy a lot of festive foods. And you know, this day brings a lot of joy and happiness in our lives. So, happy Nowruz to all of you.
Pakistan's President Asif Ali Zardari and Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif have extended their heartfelt greetings to all those who are celebrating Nowruz in Pakistan and around the world. Both leaders also called for embracing the spirit of Nowruz and promoting the message of peace, compassion, unity, and kindness.
Nowruz signifies regeneration at the start of a new cycle. It transcends simple festivity, standing as a cultural landmark that enhances the diversity of human society. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight. Israel has carried out its deadliest attacks in months on Syria, leaving dozens of people dead. The aggression has coincided with a drone attack launched by terrorists in Idlib. Israel has also ramped up its deadly airstrikes on Lebanon in recent days. This is while the regime is pressing ahead with its genocidal war on the Gaza Strip, and there seems to be no end in sight to the nearly six-month assault despite growing international pressure. On this edition of Spotlight, we'll try to find out why Israel is trying to increase tensions and what would be the repercussions of such an escalation for the entire region and beyond. Our guests on tonight's Spotlight are international human rights defender Ziad Ibrahim Patel, joining us from Johannesburg. And we also have human rights activist Mohsen Naqvi joining us from Houston, Texas. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Patel in Johannesburg. It's great to have you with us. Sir, now Israel, as we mentioned in our intros, launched a fresh attack on Syria, targeting a number of locations in the northwestern city of Aleppo. The attack has left a number of civilians and military personnel dead. It's damaged public and private property. Now, the Syrian military said the Israeli aggression coincided with a drone attack by terrorist organizations launched from Idlib and the western countryside of Aleppo. As the massacre in Gaza rages on, how do you perceive the Israelis' actions in other areas of the region? And how much of this increased aggression would you say is tied to Israel's failures in Gaza?
Good evening, and thank you for having me on your show. Yes, indeed, This is the normal course of action that Israel has been doing over many years. And as the war rages, quite rightly, in Gaza, in fact, the genocide as it rages quite in Gaza, Israel is feeling the pressure. It's feeling the pressure of their resistance movements that have continued unabated, as Israel has continued unabated in its atrocities and crimes against Palestinians. And we got to put this in context, that all these extraterritorial attacks are unlawful under international law to conduct these strikes in Syria. And again, we got to look at what was military advantage and compared to what human causation. In other words, what was the human beings that were lost in this? You know, they would call this human beings and innocent are always caught up in this conflict, unfortunately. But this continues, and Israel, we must hold Israel to account. But unfortunately, this is the situation because Israel feels that it's losing control in terms of its fight against the resistance movements and will try to suppress and equalize where it perceives threats to be. And that's why we're seeing this increased attacks in the region.
Moussa Naqvi, let's also focus on the growing tensions between Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement and forces of the Israeli regime. The Israelis have targeted a vehicle in the city of Tyre with a drone, leaving one Lebanese dead. Hezbollah has also carried out retaliatory missile strikes on Israeli positions in the occupied territories. Are the Israelis actively pursuing more tensions in the region, and how do they benefit from this?
I think this is a sign of Israel being very vulnerable and a sign of them being weak. So because they're being defeated in the Gaza Strip, the solution that they're trying to come up with is to expand the war in the region, to create chaos in the region. And that's why we see them acting so erratically, where now they've attacked Syria. The fighting on the northern front with Hezbollah has been happening since October 7th, in which many of Hezbollah's fighters have been martyred. But Hezbollah has also been retaliating strategically retaliating to Israel's attacks as well. And as a matter of fact, I wouldn't be exaggerating in stating that the role that Hezbollah has played on the northern front has led to thousands, over 10,000 settlers evacuating from that part of occupied Palestine. So Hezbollah is playing that very key role. So it is quite clear that just how Israel sees Hamas as a threat, just like they see Syria as a threat, they see Hezbollah as a threat equivalent to that of Palestinian freedom fighters. So in short, if we summarize and if we conclude that the Zionist regime of Israel considers the axis of resistance as a threat, as a genuine threat to its very existence, then we can understand the attacks on Israel. We can understand the constant attacks on the southern front in Lebanon as well. And ironically and unfortunately, the Zionist regime, another sign of their weakness is that for the most part, their targets are usually civilians, may that be in Palestine, Syria, or even Lebanon. Whereas the resistance front has always focused on targeting military personnel. And adding to the point that my colleague made earlier about Syria, I think it's important to note that the fact that Idlib, the attack of terrorists in Idlib, was seen almost coordinated with Israel's attacks, goes on to show that these splinter groups, these terrorist groups who've been operating in Idlib, who were operating in Syria, and they were kicked out by Hezbollah in Syria, have always been a proxy of the U.S. empire and the Zionist regime. They've always served their purpose. So those who are criticizing Hezbollah of intervening in Syria now understand and now know why Syria has always been of such great importance to the axis of resistance.
Mr. Patel, how important has this unified response been from the resistance front in the region? There's Lebanon, Yemen, Iraq, resistance groups in Syria. Were the Israelis in Washington expecting that from all of the resistance fronts in the region?
I think we all know that Palestine has been in a state of resistance for several decades, undergoing belligerent military occupation in the occupied Palestinian territories and in occupied Palestine at large. We've always known, and I mean the enemies of Palestine, the Americans, the Israelis, have always known that there are certain groups that will be steadfast to the standing with the resistance of Palestine, which is a fundamental right under international law, because the right to resistance is strongly associated to the right of self-determination, and Palestinians need to exert that right. So I think in some cases they may have been surprised by the broadening of the axis of resistance, as we've seen the Houthi Yemenis in Yemen, closure of the Red Sea, the stopping of ships in that area, and stopping that kind of cargo, which is a very good BDS campaign. And then we've seen the axis of resistance, Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, northern occupied Palestine, and of course in Syria and Iraq. And that needs to broaden. We need to look at this also from the context that we've got Arab countries around Palestine, Syria, Jordan, or well, let me rather put Jordan, Egypt, and other countries that have normalized. Some countries have normalized with the Zionist regime. And we've seen that there's been no real military intervention despite the carnage in Gaza. And just coming back to my previous point, and I think it's important what my colleague mentioned, is that in all of the attacks by these terror groups and Israel and backed by the U.S., and of course we must also remember that the European Union and European Union countries sell huge and license huge volumes of arms to Israel. And this is being used indiscriminately. For many years, since I think the 2009 war, when we lodged the first docket criminal complaint against Israel with South African authorities, we had focused on war crimes where Israel has perpetually used indiscriminate use of force and indistinction of military target to civilian population. That has continued. Israel continues to be responsible, criminally responsible for egregious crimes, such as crimes against humanity, crimes of apartheid, torture, forced displacement, and many other crimes. And of course, now we see genocide. Whereas the armed resistance of armed resistance groups have had focused, targeted areas. And I think when we look at this, it needs to be looked at, is it from the perspective of international law and what are the laws of war and what must be complied with and what are the levels that a certain use of force must comply with? Or do we need to look at it from an Islamic perspective of what our responsibilities are? And I think the resistance groups are very conscious of the Islamic responsibilities in terms of conflict and how to, ward off the aggressor in these instances.
Yes, let's go back to Mr. Nahvi. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has defiantly vowed to go ahead with this military campaign, this genocidal massacre, saying that the international pressure on his regime will not work. Have all the years of impunity and U.S. cover for Israel made this child-killing regime believe that it's actually above the law and it's safe from accountability?
Absolutely. There's absolutely no doubt about that, that the Zionist regime, independent of the U.S., is nothing. It has no power. The only reason why the Zionist regime has been imposed on the region of West Asia is because of the support that it gains from the U.S. Within the international community. We now see that the European Union is also taking a very clear stance in shifting away from being a party to the Zionist
the Israeli Zionist crime that they're committing in Gaza today. We see them taking a slightly different line from the Zionist regime. But the one country that we still see to date that unequivocally supports the Israeli regime, may that be militarily, may that be diplomatically, may that be in the international arena, in the United Nations, that is the United States of America. So now it makes sense when Imam Khomeini said that America is the great Satan, that America is Shaitan and Buzurg. When Imam Khomeini said that, many must have not understood that statement before. But it is now seen, it is now, we can now conclude that the statement that was made by Imam Khomeini, it had a lot of wisdom in it. The Zionist regime is not the real issue, but it is rather the policies of the U.S. empire that has empowered this weak, this so-called state, this occupying power, which is as weak as the spider's web in that region. And another statement that I would like to make in addition to the previous question that was asked a few minutes back is that when the Zionist regime tries to target military personnel from Hezbollah, like they targeted Shahid Ali Abdul Hassan Naim, who was one of the leaders of the heavy warhead rocket fire unit of Hezbollah, they need to understand that, and they already know, but just to kind of reiterate for the audience, is that Hezbollah is a very organized, it's an organized military giant in the region now. They thought that they'll be able to weaken Hezbollah when Imad Mughniyeh was martyred. They thought that after Jihad Mughniyeh is martyred, when Shahid Badruddin is martyred, or when Shahid Abbas Musawi or Sheikh Raghib or Hadi Nasrullah, when they're martyred, Hezbollah will become weak. But history has shown us that the school of martyrdom within Hezbollah has only strengthened Hezbollah and has made them into the giant that they are today. They are so organized that they work in ways that they always have parallel leaderships within their divisions, like any other military power.
Mr. Patel, Hamas has hailed a ruling by the International Court of Justice ordering the Israeli regime to address famine in Gaza. The reaction came after the ICJ ordered Israel to allow the immediate delivery of humanitarian supplies into Gaza. Hamas has called on the international community to create a mechanism to ensure the order's implementation. How do you see that happening? What would be step one in your opinion?
Yes, I think this is an important development. And to give your viewers context, I think South Africa has been busy with this since January or December, when the hearings initially started at the International Court of Justice. The application was made. And in fact, the ICJ has now issued three orders in terms of provisional measures. Initially, the provisional measures were very clear and succinct that there needs to be a humanitarian corridor and there needs to be access to aid. And that was one of the conditions. We saw the United States and Israel use it in a different way. They've used the hasbara and the spin on the order, stating that the word ceasefire was not included. But the order could not be effected without an effective ceasefire because of the humanitarian aid that was required at scale. Subsequently to that, South Africa requested further measures to the International Court of Justice. And the response from the ICJ was that no further provisional measures were required. Israel was bound to the initial order that was given by the court. And just recently, the order based on famine and starvation, we know that the catastrophic situation that now exists in Gaza. Northern Gaza is effectively now separated from southern Gaza. Netanyahu has spoken about a demilitarized zone, which means effectively more belligerent military occupation. And certainly that famine and starvation is a serious problem. South Africa in its application stated that there's almost a concern for about 80,000 civilian deaths that are imminent if this problem is not seriously redressed, as there's imminent harm to a civilian population. And of course, there was also the UN rapporteur that came out with a report, An Anatomy of a Genocide, claiming that Israel is guilty of at least 3 of the 5 acts in terms of the Genocide Convention. So the international pressure is mounting. The international community has spoken clearly through the General Assembly. Unfortunately, the UN Security Council has always been politicized, and we've seen the number of vetoes that the US has exercised. But my view, and I've just come back from Tehran recently, is that there's nothing stopping Islamic states or Muslim countries from intervening in this crisis. And in fact, my belief is that they should have intervened from the very outset, because we know that Israel is now a ultra-right Zio-fascist government, and they've been hell-bent on the destruction of the Palestinian population. We're not only seeing this genocide unfold in Gaza, but also the increased raids in the occupied yes. Palestinian territories. So Muslim countries and countries should intervene, but they need to be politically enabled and not be politically influenced and controlled, unfortunately, by the Western powers that have neutralized them. That is the reality of the fact that they've been utterly neutralized. Indeed. Only way that we gain being able to see any movement is through the resistance or the axis of resistance, but they're not going to be enabled to be able to provide the humanitarian aid at scale. So I think we've got to insist on the international measures and the international community to force Israel to comply with the International Court of Justice orders, that humanitarian aid be delivered,
right.
That access to borders be opened, and that it be provided to the needs of the Gazan population.
Mohsen Naavi, we're running short of time, but I want you to discuss a video that surfaced showing Israeli forces executing unarmed Palestinians near Gaza's coast. They were waving white flags in a show of surrender. The Israeli soldiers, after murdering them, they went on to bury their bodies in the sand with a bulldozer. Is this a clear indication that this genocidal massacre has not only been a war against Gaza's resistance, but actually against all of its people?
Absolutely. The resistance has simply been used as a pretext. The civilians in Gaza have not, this is not recent. This war did not start after October 7th, as most of the world might think. But this genocide against the innocent civilians of Gaza is exactly why you now have freedom fighters in the shape of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, the Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigades, who are now defending the very rights of their people. And also I would like to reiterate the fact that to go down on such low levels, to assault and to disrespect civilians in such a manner can only be expected of the Zionist regime, and only goes on to show how weak they are. That because they cannot fight like real men, they can't fight the military, they can't fight Palestinian freedom fighters, they exert their frustration and their pressure on innocent civilians by disrespecting and insulting them like this. But they need to understand sure. that this regime is only exposing themselves when they act in such a manner.
Okay, I'm sorry. We're running short of time now. Allow me to thank my guests, Ziad Ibrahim Patel, international human rights defender, joining us from Johannesburg, and human rights activist Mohsen Naavi, speaking to us from Houston, Texas. Thank you, gentlemen, and also allow me to thank our viewers for staying with us on tonight. Spotlight is good night for now, and see you next time.
Imam Ali, peace be upon him, said, "The Lord Most High has chosen for us certain followers, Shiites, who assist us. If we are joyful, they are joyful. And if we are sorrowful and sad, they are sorrowful and sad."
in the limelight.
Thousands of foreign nurses are leaving the United Kingdom to work abroad. This has raised fears that Britain is simply a staging post for their careers. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Almost 9,000 foreign nurses a year are leaving the United Kingdom to work abroad amid a sudden surge in nurses quitting the already understaffed National Health Service for better paid jobs elsewhere. The rise in nurses originally from outside of the European Union moving to take up new posts abroad has prompted concerns that Britain is increasingly becoming a staging post in their careers. The number of UK-registered nurses moving to other countries doubled in just 1 year, between 2021-2022 and 2022-2023, to a record 12,400 cases, and has soared fourfold since before the coronavirus pandemic. 7 out of 10 of those leaving last year, 8,680 individuals, qualified as a nurse somewhere other than the United Kingdom or the European Union, often in India or the Philippines. Many had worked in Britain for up to 3 years, according to research from the Health Foundation. The vast majority of those quitting are heading to the United States, to New Zealand or Australia, where nurses are paid much more than in the United Kingdom, sometimes up to almost double the pay. Experts have voiced their alarm about the findings and said the National Health Service across the United Kingdom, already struggling with about 40,000 vacancies for nurses and hugely reliant on those coming from abroad, is increasingly losing out in the global recruitment race. It feels like the National Health Service is falling down the league table as a destination of choice for overseas nurses, said Dame Anne-Marie Rafferty, a professor of nursing studies at King's College London. Dame Anne-Marie Rafferty added, worryingly, it feels as if the United Kingdom is perceived not as a high but middle-income country in pay terms and as a staging post where nurses from overseas can acclimatise to Western-type health systems in the search for better pay and better working conditions. Last year, 12,400 nurses working in the United Kingdom applied for a Certificate of Current Professional Status, or CCPS, which they need to have to move to work in another country, according to the research foundation, the Health Foundation. British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. Thousands of foreign nurses a year are leaving the United Kingdom to find better paid jobs abroad. The surge in nurses originally from outside the European Union moving overseas has prompted fears that Britain is becoming a staging post in their careers. Almost 9,000 foreign nurses a year are leaving Britain to work abroad, amid a sudden surge in nurses quitting the already understaffed National Health Service. Last year, 12,400 nurses working in the United Kingdom applied for a Certificate of Current Professional Status, or CCPS, which they need to have to move to work in another country. The largest increase among that group was in overseas trained nurses who had only worked in the United Kingdom for 3 years or less. That pronounced trend in short stays suggests that for many recruits from abroad, Britain may be just a stepping stone prior to moving to other destinations. The think tank, the Health Foundation, pointed out that the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, data showed that while a nurse in the United Kingdom earned on average $46,000 a year, substantially less than in Australia, where a nurse can earn up to $71,000, or New Zealand, where a nurse can earn up to $57,000, and the United States, where nurses can earn up to $84,000. Application for a CCPS to work in America rose tenfold between 2021-2022 and 2022-2023, after a change in its visa policy meant many more foreign nurses were able to move there. The Royal College of Nursing said the growing exodus of overseas-trained nurses was due to significant erosion in pay, and nursing profession has suffered since 2010. Professor Pat Cullen, the Royal College of Nursing's chief executive and general secretary, said it is deeply worrying to see more and more overseas nurses choosing to leave Britain. The recruitment of domestic nurses is collapsing, and services are gripped by workforce shortages. With patient needs already going unmet, the prospect of losing more of our international colleagues doesn't bear thinking about, he said. Professor Pat Cullen added, "The reality is that sustained attacks on pay and poor working conditions are leaving the UK's healthcare services unable to compete on the world stage. International nurses, like all nurses, have every right to choose to work in countries that better value their skills and expertise. It's no joke that nursing pay in the United Kingdom is joint bottom of 35 OECD countries." The report's co-author, Elaine Kelly, the assistant director at the Health Foundation's Research Centre, said that with an acute nursing shortage and so many overseas nurses quitting the United Kingdom, if the National Health Service is to avoid becoming a stepping stone to careers elsewhere, it needs to be a more attractive place to work for all nurses, regardless of where they were trained. Elaine Kelly added, "The brain drain was especially worrying because it cost the National Health Service about £10,000 to replace each foreign recruit who then moved elsewhere." The Department of Health and Social Care said it did not recognise the Health Foundation's figures. The largest nursing and midwifery council data showed fewer nurses, those trained in the United Kingdom and outside of the UK, leaving the National Health Service, according to a spokesperson. "We hugely value the care provided by our fantastic nurses, which is why we negotiated a fair and reasonable deal with the trade unions, delivering a 5% pay rise for the nurses, two additional one-off bonuses equivalent to 6% of pay, and a series of non-pay measures to support the NHS workforce in England." The spokesperson added, "We also delivered on our commitment to recruit an additional 50,000 NHS nurses 6 months early, and the first ever long-term workforce plan, backed by over £2.4 billion of government funding, will provide the biggest training expansion in the National Health Service history, ensuring that up to 130,000 fewer staff, including nurses, will leave the NHS over the next 15 years.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Scores more Palestinians are killed in Israel's indiscriminate strikes across Gaza as the total death toll from the regime's genocidal war tops 32,700. The Secretary General